I'm Kelsey. I'm an alcoholic. I'm gonna start with thanks, Mike, for that intro. What an intro. And let's then go with the Serenity Prayer. So have a moment of silence for the alcoholic still sick and suffering. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay, it's hard to tell up here. It's loud over there, but here it's nothing. Cool, well, I'll just start like I always start. My sobriety date is August 29th, 2019. My home group is the Damariscotta Beginners Group in Damariscotta, Maine. Right now I'm the literature, chairperson. That sounds fancy. I just order, when we run out of books or chips, I just get those. I just keep a little inventory, and every week I go and say, oh, probably get a couple living sober this week, you know. and actually, I say this week. It's like once every couple months I might order something. But so the service position in that home group is really fulfilling, and service is a really big part of my story. Mike mentioned that we met at an area assembly, probably a year and a half ago. Sounds right. And I'll go with the format. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Thanks to Nikki. Oh yeah, also thanks Nikki for asking me to speak. I think it was at the assembly. Nikki came up to me and she's like, Kelsey, are you going to the roundup? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to the roundup. And she's like, oh good, will you be the speaker? And I was like, oh yeah, sure. Which is sort of how I get into any service in AA, or at least how I started. People were always like, oh, you're interested in doing something? Well, how about this thing? why not? But that's what I learned in AA, was to say yes to things that are healthy. And my sponsor back in Georgia before I moved here used to say that spiritual growth doesn't happen in our comfort zone. It really happens outside our comfort zone. And I have found that, you know, this is something else I learned. I got very alcoholic about that. She said that, and I was like, cool, I'm going to always be uncomfortable. I'm going to move to Maine. Like, I'm going to do something crazy. I'm going to get a job where I don't know anything. I'm going to do this. You know, I'm, going to do the most uncomfortable things. And then I was like, oh, like, I learned after I moved to Maine that maybe I don't always have to be out of my comfort zone. Maybe I could take a little, a little middle way there. But, I still learned, ultimately, that saying yes to things that are uncomfortable and are of service is how I grow, and it's a real honor to be here opening up the roundup. It's sort of astounding, can't believe I'm here. But so what it was like when I was drinking was very different. I tried very, very hard to live in my comfort zone, and ultimately, you know, that comfort zone sort of was like a mirage, really. I was always trying to get there by putting something in my body, but I guess I'll start at the beginning. I keep an eye on the time here, just in case I've gone on for an hour already. That's interesting. I feel like the topic of the idea of comfort or comfort zone, like I was a really uncomfortable person, uncomfortable in my skin, kind of just felt like I didn't know how to express my feelings. I had a lot of big feelings. I didn't know what to do with them. I didn't know how to do things right. Even from a young age, it was really an obsession of mine, was to do things right and be good and be perfect at things, and take that to kind of an extreme. And I come from a long line of alcoholics and addicts who, you know, some of them are in recovery, some of them have been in and out, and I learned from a pretty early age that I didn't want to drink, I didn't want to smoke, I didn't want to cuss, I wasn't going to have premarital sex. I had some real big aspirations in my life, and didn't live up to any of them, but here I am, that's all right. I really didn't want to be like that. I didn't want to be like the people I saw in my family and all their friends, you know. Not maybe not all their friends, but a lot of them. So I thought if I could just be good, if I could just be, if I could do well in school and, have the right aspirations, if I could do what I should do, what I'm supposed to do, I would be fine. And it just kind of left me feeling really, like a wreck, really. And so when I was actually, before I ever picked up a drink or a drug, I had attempted suicide. I think I was 15. No, I was 14. And I was hospitalized, and in Georgia they call it 1013. You can't leave. I think they call it like blue papered here or something. I hear that in meetings. But I got 1013, and the doctor started giving me a lot of pills, and I was like, oh, great, like a solution. Yes, give me those. And I wouldn't say that's what started me down a path, but I definitely had this idea that there was a solution outside of myself. And that was sort of an idea handed down the line, you know, from my family and all the people I saw, and that there was a solution, yeah, that was something external. And so I took the pills as prescribed for a while, and I was like, eh, we'll try this thing. It's kind of like a little guinea pig game for me, and didn't work out too well. And then I remember I used drugs before. Drugs are kind of a big part of my story. I used drugs before I ever drank alcohol, and I remember feeling like, wow, this was the solution. I just shared at the Camden 12-step group maybe a month ago, so if you were there, thanks for coming to this one too. but I feel like I started like self-medicating, and I had heard that phrase in like a negative connotation, and then I did it, and I, especially after having all this experience for like a whole, maybe almost 2 years of being like medicated by doctors, I was like, I couldn't fathom why it's a bad thing to self-medicate, because I was like, at least I'm medicating, and it's better now, like I'm better now. And then, shortly after I had used for the first time, I drank for the first time, and that was like, okay, technically my first consensual drink when I was like 17, I only took one shot and I didn't like it. And then I thought it's because I didn't drink enough. I just got a headache. I didn't get a buzz even. And I thought, and I think this is such an alcoholic tell that I was like, I didn't like that. I should do more next time. Next time I'll just do more. And so I did. And that I have such a clear memory of that night and who was there. And actually I was just thinking about this. You know, I've thought a lot about this speaking engagement in particular, to the point that I feel like because I was asked several months ago, I like had like 3 sleepless nights in a row. I was like, I'm going to say this. No, I'm going to say this. No, this. And I went through it so many times that now I forgot whatever it was that I was going to say. But I remember I was just thinking about this for some reason. You know, I was thinking about kind of my first real drunk. And there was a guy there, and we bonded over our shared love of being inebriated. And it was some guy I went to high school with, and he actually killed himself like several years ago. And that was sort of a, you know, it's not foreign, I'm sure, to anybody in this room. A lot of the people that I was drinking and using with on a regular basis died alcoholic deaths, or they killed themselves, or they overdosed, you know. And it was really, it was like I was blind to that for so many years, you know. So I remember feeling like this was it. This was it. Finally, this was it. Like, this is why I'm so anxious, so depressed. I just need to do what everybody else is apparently doing, everybody I saw, and just get drunk. What? This is so simple. You know, why why was I making it so complicated? Well, it wasn't that simple. So that was, it was sort of like fun for a little bit when I was in high school. My first couple years of high school before I ever picked up, I was an all-A student. I was like, all the extracurricular activities, all these things. And by the time I graduated high school, literally like by the skin of my teeth, I was failing classes. I still somehow graduated with honors because I did so well, so overachieving in my first couple of years. But I was like, you know, I skipped so many classes that I thought I was gonna fail, but then our principal died and they like, I don't know why. I don't understand, but they made it so that it didn't matter. If you were absent, if you were late to class, you would get detention, but if you skipped the whole class, you wouldn't get detention. So I was like, especially one class I had that was after lunch, I would like leave and go get high or whatever and come back to school, but then I would be running late, so I can't go to that class now. So there was this one math class, and I almost failed because it was after lunch. But then that year, yeah, they absolved all absences for some reason. So that's the only reason, you know, and like all these like little, I don't know, it was just like, I was really good at finding the loophole and finding like how I could manipulate the situation to get as drunk and high as I wanted to and do as little as possible and like still make it, you know. That was kind of my MO. So that was like, I mean, I wouldn't say it was fun. It was exhausting. I think in my mind at the time, it's like it was more fun than being sober, but it wasn't. I don't think it was that fun. But then I, at some point, there was sort of like a turning point in my drinking pretty early on. I was 17, so I hadn't been drinking for that long. I was studying abroad in China, which was something that I wouldn't have done. I applied to that program before I started drinking. I wouldn't have gone to study abroad in China if I was drinking. But unbeknownst to me, in China, alcohol is readily available to white people of any age. I don't know what the laws are there. They're pretty strict about things for Chinese people, but they love Americans. So you can do whatever you want. Like, for alcohol-wise, they're really strict on drugs. I think you could go to jail forever because of the opium wars, but they're really lax on alcohol. They're like, whatever. You're American. You're probably old enough. that was like, you know, my drinking really took off. I actually ended up getting sent home early from that program. What do you know? But also while I was there, I was assaulted. And right before I had left, my sister-in-law, who I was very close with, had died from alcohol poisoning. And at the age of 32, and my brother, her husband, sort of got in a mild shootout with police at this motel. But it's hard to explain. It's a long story, but it doesn't matter. There was like this pervasive chaos. That was just like another day. And the pervasive chaos had like come to a head with all this like dying. My brother's in jail and whatever. And, you know, I didn't know if he was going to die or not that day. And that was like a month before I went to China, and then I was assaulted, and I was just like, it was like too much for me to handle anymore. And I remember, like, prior to that, I had been, like, when I would drink or get high, I was like, wow, like, this is nice. I like the way I feel. I want to do this again because I like the way I feel. This is better than the way I felt earlier. But then it was like there was this turning point I remember very clearly this time also where I said to myself, I don't want to think about this. I don't want to feel this. So instead of drinking to feel something else, I was drinking to not feel, like, very consciously to not feel this. And it was like lost on me. And like I said, that guy that committed suicide, you know, my sister-in-law had just died, lost on me that could be a consequence for me, you know, death. And really, I had been, up until, I don't know, probably 3 months into sobriety, I feel like I was like a low level of suicidal ideation for 15 years or so, I don't know, like most of my life. And I was 23 when I got sober, so that's a pretty long time for someone to be thinking that I could just die and I'd be fine. And, you know, more or less like active in that thought. But, you know, it didn't matter. It didn't matter that I might die. I think that was more what it was. I don't think that I didn't think I might die. I just didn't care. So anyway, I came back stateside and everything just really ramped up. I think in total I've been hospitalized 4 times, like 10-13 type, you know, blue papered. In 4 institutions, and that was all by the time I was like 19. And just, you know, I like really turned my whole life. I had all these aspirations, right, that I wanted to be whatever I should be and be good and perfect and get good grades and get a good job and whatever. And then, like, immediately, you know, after I actually was in college when I was a senior in high school because I just didn't want to go to class. And if I went to college, most of the classes like didn't count. I only needed 1 credit to graduate, so I like did this dual enrollment program because I had the good grades in the beginning, and it looked like I was doing good on paper, and I don't know, I just like fell through the cracks a little bit too, on purpose. I like wiggled, I wouldn't say I fell, I wiggled through the cracks. I was like, yes, like truly, how could I not go to class? I'll just go to college, I won't go to class there, and it won't matter because those don't count toward my high school GPA, and I can find college people who will buy me alcohol. I mean, it was like a perfect plan. So I did that, and I was in college for, I don't know, a total of 3 years on and off, and I'm, like, still, like, 3 years away from not being a freshman, or 3 hours away from not being a freshman anymore at this to this day. On my, like, college transcript somewhere out there, I'm still a freshman after 3 years. So that's about how seriously I took it, but I found a lot of people that like to drink like me, and then I found a job at a bar, and then I think that was when I decided I didn't need to go to college anymore because now I had this job where I could just steal alcohol or they would buy me alcohol. So anyway, it was just like, I mean, just ad infinitum. Like, just take that picture I just painted for you and then draw it out over the course of, like, 4 more years. And, you know, I had all these, I mean, I was homeless, I don't know, three times or something, three separate times. You know, I was living in these crazy places. Sometimes even if I had a somewhat decent home to go to, I just couldn't handle being alone. I would go to like this one house. I knew there was a party 7 days a week. And I would just sit there. I wouldn't really talk to people. I would just drink or do drugs and watch people drink and do drugs and be really lonely and angry. And I was so angry. Oh my God. And resentful and just think about how miserable my life is and how everybody had screwed me over and this and that. And anyway, you know, I broke my shoulder one time because I was skateboarding to work drunk and I was running late. So it wasn't because I was drinking. I actually had less to drink that day than I would on an average day at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock whenever I was supposed to be at work. But you know, there was a crack in the sidewalk. I didn't usually skate on that part of the sidewalk because of all the cracks, but I was running late, so I was in a hurry. So that was why I broke my shoulder. Nothing to do in my mind with drinking. I mean, I checked all the boxes. Like, I remember when I came into AA, I found like the pamphlet, Is AA for You? I think is what it's called. Is AA for Me or something? And there's like 12 questions. And I got 11 out of 12 on the pamphlet. You know, they're like, do you ever drink in the morning? Have you ever been injured while drinking? Do you ever black out? Like all these kind of questions. If you answered yes to four or more, I think you might be a problem drinker was the consensus of the pamphlet. So I got an 11 out of 12. And the one I answered no to was, does anybody ever bother you about your drinking? Like, does anybody ever say, hey, I think you drink too much, you should chill out? And nobody ever said that because I had cut off anybody who might even think to say that. I mean, they didn't have a chance to get to that point because everybody in my life that I surrounded myself with was doing just like I was, you know, and it was so normal. And I didn't really know. I guess I had maybe an idea that there were other ways to live, but it just didn't even cross my mind. So I think when I, like, you know, I was blacking out, I was drinking against my will all the time. I just didn't want to drink anymore, really. I remember even when I was 21, I, like, found another loophole. I wasn't going to go out drinking on my 21st birthday because I had this job where I would have to go. I was, like, a event staff, quote-unquote security for sporting events. Laughable to think that at that time when I was 20 and drunk all the time that they're letting me be a security. Like, I'm, like, responsible for other people's well-being. Oh, my God. But I couldn't be responsible for my own well-being, but I really got the job because I couldn't lift anything because of my shoulder. It was a lot of, like, standing around, like, the bathroom is on the left, you know. That was mostly what I did. It was, like, stand there for 12 hours and say the bathroom is on the left. thank God nothing ever happened because that would have been terrible. But anyway, I had to get up super early to go to that job the day after my 21st birthday, and I was, like, I'm not going to go out drinking because I already know. You know, I don't know where I might end up. I don't know. I know I'll get drunk. Like, also, there's never really an idea in my mind that I wouldn't get drunk because I wanted to get drunk. Like the doctor's opinion says, you know, I drank for the effect produced. I did not drink for the taste. I've never found an alcohol I enjoyed the taste of. There are a lot of other side effects in terms of like getting sick or bad taste or dry, whatever, like, there are tons of other side effects to all the drugs and alcohol that I drank and used that I didn't care about because I wanted the effect produced. That was the bottom line for me. And I didn't understand when I read the doctor's opinion why it would even say that, because I could not conceptualize that there are people who drink for any reason other than the effect produced. But apparently they're out there. I've now met some of them. Because I'm now not associating with these like other low bottom drunks, I like associate with like normal people out in society, and I've met some of these people who drink because of the taste. I just don't get it, but that's fine. I don't care. I don't think about it too much. But anyway, I knew I might, on my 21st birthday, if I went out, I might end up somewhere crazy. I don't know. Anything could happen. I could hurt myself again. I could, whatever, like, whatever amount of craziness, you know, I might just completely black out and miss my alarm. I might let my phone die. It doesn't, you know, I might not have my phone. I just probably won't get to work, was the bottom line. If I go out drinking, I will not make it to my 5 a.m. call time, for sure, drunk or sober. So I was like, the day before my 21st birthday, I don't remember why, but I was talking to somebody about this, and I was like, somehow I really just didn't want to drink. I was like, I think I should just not. And I ended up going out at midnight the night before, like, obviously, like, 21 was not really much of a milestone for me anyway, because I had already been drinking for years and was actually sort of thinking maybe I should not drink. In the back of my mind somewhere, you know, like, maybe this is sort of a problem. But I talked myself into it just because I wanted to drink. And that was like, you know, that's just how it went. And so I remember, I think I was 22. Yeah. I had really started to try in earnest sometime between 21 and 22 to quit drinking. And I would get, you know, I don't know, a week, a month, and that was not doable for me. I just couldn't handle life sober. Well, I couldn't handle life not drinking. I wasn't sober. I was still using a lot of drugs, even in these times where I was trying to quit drinking, but I just couldn't stop drinking. And finally, I had stopped, and I tried in that time period a lot of, like, switching to, you know, like it said in the Big Book, there's that passage. I think this is the first time I related to the Big Book. It's in one of the first couple chapters where it says, you know, we tried many things for drinking. We tried taking a trip, not taking a trip, switching from liquor to beer, switching from scotch to brandy, never drinking in the morning, never drinking alone, only drinking with friends, never keeping it in the house. I mean, it was like me to a T. I was like, oh my God, they're talking about me. This is for the first time. I understand what they're saying. I did that. And I think that was like a turning point in my recovery. But I think I was like not drinking liquor anymore, quote unquote. And then I ended up getting drunk at some wedding and there was liquor, you know, and it was, I remember that was April 15th, 2018. So that was my last drink because I was so ashamed of myself. I didn't even really do anything that crazy other than drive drunk, which I did all the time. So that wasn't crazy to me, but I didn't get embarrassed. You know, I didn't like do anything crazy. I don't even think that I blacked out in my last drunk, but I just was so ashamed of myself. And I had stopped telling people already that I quit drinking, really. That was like, because it was never true. So I just stopped. I just gave up. But anyway, that was April 15th, 2018. And I remember on April 15th, 2019, which was about, what is the math? April, May, June, July, like 4 months before my actual sobriety date, I remember sitting down and thinking, I thought my life would be better. It's been a whole year since I've had a drink, and it's not better, it's worse. I was angrier, more depressed, more anxious, less able to cope with anything. I mean, the littlest things, you know, would just set me off into a rage or a panic, and I just could not handle life, and I was just so unhappy. And I was like, why? You know, I really thought in my mind, like, if I could go a whole year without a drink, things would be good. The problem would be solved, and it was not. And then I just continued to be miserable and angry and take it out on everybody around me. And now it wasn't fun. And I wasn't blacking out, so I could remember all the stupid things I was doing, not just most of them, you know? And that was a problem. So I ended up getting fired from this job at, we'll say it was not a very esteemed restaurant in my town. and that was the last straw. That was August like 27th, 2019. And I was like, I can't believe it. Was because I was being mean and rude and yelling at people. I was being a jerk at work. And for the umpteenth time, and it was like the last straw for them. And boy, talk about some shame and fear. Like, what am I gonna do? Now I don't have any money. Like, I can't buy the drugs that I'm using, you know, like, because I wasn't sober in this, like, year and 4 months. I was just not drinking, and that was a problem. And so I went to, I must have been borrowing somebody's car. I did not have a car at the time, but somebody was loaning me their car, which is crazy. Again, I don't know. I really, like, could manipulate people into things, I guess. But I was borrowing a car, and I remember sitting outside of a liquor store. And I was so upset, you know, I was crying, and I really, all I thought about, like, in that moment, and for probably almost every waking moment and sleeping, last sleeping moments from, you know, April 15th, 2018 until this day, August 27th, 2019, was just how much I wanted to drink. I would still go to bars with my friends, I would watch them drink, I would get resentful that they were drinking and that I wasn't, which had nothing to do with them. I would count their drinks. I would think about what I, you know, I was just like obsessed with alcohol for that whole time. And it was just really coming to a head in this moment. I was sitting outside this liquor store and I really wanted to go in. But I also had this, like, what I now know was the grace of God, this like intuitive thought, this knowledge that if I went in there, I was going to make up for lost time. I would not have a choice. Like, I was now going to have to, somehow, for some reason, I was going to have to make up for this year and 4 months that I had not drank a drop of alcohol, and that because I hadn't had any in so long, I could very well die. And that even if I didn't die soon, I would, if I went and got alcohol that day, I was going to die from drinking. I just knew it. And I knew if I didn't start drinking soon, I was going to kill myself. So I was like, this is like a real rock and a hard place situation. But I did also have, like, I had in my childhood a real firm concept of a higher power who was loving and benevolent and very, like, wasn't religious, it was very spiritual, and I had really turned away from that, especially after my sister-in-law died. For a while I was very angry at God, and then I thought maybe there is no God, and then I had come to rest on this place after a while that if there is a God, that he was, or it was, like, a vindictive thing, or at the very least just kind of laughing at our misfortune. I don't know. That was my thought. But I had also started to become really desperate for spiritual connection again, because I had experienced that at some point before I started using and drinking. And my family wasn't a church-going family, but I started trying to go to church a lot in the last, like, I don't know, 3 weeks before that day when I got fired. I had gone as a kid to this, like, spiritual center in Myrtle Beach, and done a lot of service work there, and felt very, like, rewarded by all the service work. But the rules at the spiritual center was you couldn't drink and you couldn't bring any drugs or alcohol on the property. And that was a problem for me. I could not go a day without being inebriated and putting something in my body to change the way I felt. So I didn't go for a period of years to the spiritual center that I used to go, like, with my mom once a year. And when I would go there, I would, like, this is not part of really the spiritual center, but it was something I really enjoyed, was I would clean the cabins with the cabin crew as a kid. And I just loved being of service. And so, you know, not only did I turn away from a higher power, I really turned away from doing anything for anyone else. So I had found myself in this moment outside this liquor store, and I said a prayer to a God that I was, like, trying to reconnect with. And, like, I had had glimpses in the last year or so of that time when I wasn't drinking, where I was like, oh, I think there is a higher power and it is loving. But then I would, like, get high again, and it was gone. Like, the connection was gone, it was shut off again. But now I was aware enough, because I wasn't drinking, to know that that connection could be there but was gone every time I was inebriated. It was gone. And that was awful. Awful knowledge. At least when I was drinking, I just didn't, you know, that oblivion, like, was, I guess, I was obliviated enough that it didn't matter that the connection was gone. But I said a little prayer, and then I called somebody who actually, it was like a family friend who I knew who had quit drinking and using along, like, spiritual lines, not through AA. I didn't really know a lot about AA. Somebody previously at a different job I had 12-stepped me sort of subtly, so I knew where a meeting was, but I didn't know anything else about AA. And my dad is actually in AA. He's been sober for about 32 years now, so he's been sober for longer than I've been alive. But he, thankfully, never said anything really about AA, because I think I would have been going the other direction from whatever suggestions he was making. So he did the right thing, but I think that was probably really hard for him. Anyway, said this prayer, called this friend. They ended up calling me back, and I went to her house, and we were talking, and I was, you know, telling her what was going on. I got fired from this restaurant. I was really upset. Like, I've been thinking about going to an AA meeting. Isn't that crazy? And she was like, no, I think that's a great idea. And I was like, oh, no, I meant for you to say, yeah, that's crazy. Oh, and so now, like, the seed is, like, sort of planted in my head. And, you know, she's, like, never been to an AA meeting before or since in her life, but she had the sense to say, yeah, that's a great idea. And we did used to drink together years before that. She had moved away and then moved back and was, like, you know, clean and sober now. And so I think I went home and I used for the last time, and again, just had that awful feeling. I didn't want to anymore. I really didn't want to anymore. And it didn't work anymore. Just like the drinking, nothing I put in my body could make it better anymore. Then the next day after I got fired, I was sober for one entire day all by myself, and that was even worse. I was like, how could this be worse than when I was using against my will and drinking against my will? Oh my God. So I was coming out of my skin. I was like, all right, I was desperate. I'm going to try this AA thing. So that next day, the 29th, I walked into my first AA meeting about 5 minutes late, and I walked in the door that was like if there was a door right behind me, I walked in that door, and everybody was like, oh, we haven't seen this person, you know, like, and they're like, are there any newcomers? And I was like, You know, like barely raised my hand, like slouched down in my chair, and everybody had already looked at me. I didn't need to raise my hand. They knew. I looked rough. I was physically, mentally, spiritually broken. I had had some crazy, like, sort of mysterious back issue with like a pinched nerve in my back. I was walking with a cane at the age of 23. I could not walk up and down stairs in my house. It was crazy. I was just so angry and so clenched all the time and so emotionally, like, just so out of whack. And I would also, I think I attribute my mysterious back injury to, like, passing out in crazy ways and places for so many years. Really, I think that it, like, you know, my back got all twisted up and my spirit was all twisted up. And, you know, in my view now, like, the as above, so below kind of idea, I was just twisted up in every way. And anyway, I went to that first meeting. I don't remember anything that anybody said at all until the Lord's Prayer. Like, it was all just, like, I don't know if they could have said anything. I wouldn't have known it. I just couldn't understand anything. I was so out of my mind. They said the Lord's Prayer at the end, and I was like, I had no idea that AA had anything to do with spirituality, or God, or anything. Religion didn't matter to me at that point. I was like, what? These people are praying together? Wow, that's cool. I want that. I want to pray with people. I want a spiritual community. And they don't drink. Oh my God, this could be for me. And then as I was leaving, there was a, like, the other door that didn't come in. And there was a big sign on the door that said, keep coming back. It works. And for some reason that, like, implanted in my mind. I was like, oh my God. And there's a sign that says it works. I'll keep coming back. Perfect. And that was all it took. It didn't matter what else they said. And I didn't actually go and pick up a white chip. I never did the little walk of shame. Some woman, because I didn't understand the chip club. I was like, what are they doing? What is this? Oh, it's over. Okay, whatever. And this lady, like, came up to me after the meeting, like, handed me a white chip and was like, just take it. Keep coming back. And I was like, okay, what is this? I don't know. but, you know, I did that. And I figured out what it was all about over a long period of months, really, before I could, like, get my head straight. You know, I did get a sponsor, like, in my first 5 days, because the group that I went to had I just kept going to meetings, because I didn't have anything else to do. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any friends. All I had were customers, really, that were buying drugs from me, and that was a line I said I would never cross, selling drugs. Oh, there were so many lines, but that was, like, another line I had crossed. So no longer had friends, I just had customers. I didn't have a job, so what else am I going to do? I'll go to an AA meeting. I think on, like, my fifth day, you know, they had done the reading every day. Like, we suggest that you get a sponsor. A sponsor is somebody who could show you how to work the steps, which is the program of recovery or something like that. And I was like, they were like, you know, so I asked somebody, like, how do you get a sponsor? Like, just talk to somebody who said something that you might, you know, relate to or that you thought sounded good. So I asked them to be my sponsor, and oh my God, it's so late. that person ended up not being the right person to sponsor me. They're pretty new in sobriety themselves, but they did say yes, and they did loan me their big book, which I thought was, now knowing, is so cool. And actually, that guy is a really good friend of mine now. We talk all the time. And he, you know, he was having a lot of trouble staying sober himself, but he did ultimately, he's like coming up on 2 years now, actually, and that is so cool to me. Like, just proof that it works. He really had to keep at it. And we help each other out now, because that's what we do in here. But I got a different sponsor, and then that sort of wasn't the sponsor for me either, but I did start working the steps with her, and we got to, like, step 8, and I was like, I don't know. I was going to a meeting every day, one or more a day. You know, I was, like, involved in service. I started literally cleaning ashtrays. That's not super common these days, but there were a lot of smokers where I got sober in Georgia, and they had ashtrays outside, and that was my first service position. And, you know, I started making coffee and opening up the meeting and doing all, and, you know, she was like, yeah, you're doing all the right things, but I don't know, it just wasn't a good fit. And I ended up meeting this lady, Lindsay, who was a really good fit, and I, you know, like, that was hard. That was so hard when I was, I don't know, 6 months sober to, like, to talk to somebody and be like, hey, I actually found somebody else I want to be my sponsor. And she was like, okay, cool, call me anytime. Like, let's go to a meeting together. And I was like, oh, that was hard. Okay, I thought you were going to be so mad at me. No, she was super nice. And yeah, so I went really all the way. We started back over at step 1, and I went very thoroughly. I just didn't understand the fourth step that first time. So when I did it again, you know, this other sponsor, she really explained it to me in such detail and had just like such great questions that she asked me when we went through, you know, step one, two, and three. And then I did my fifth step and I was like, wow, I was so nervous about that. And it really, it says in the book, when you get to like the quote unquote fifth step promises, that we can look the world in the eye, you know, like we no longer have like a fear of being around people, being in the world, being a part of things. And that was, I didn't understand how that could be possible, but it was. And I didn't, you know, I also feel like there was sort of a turning point for me. That was probably around, I don't know, I was probably like 7 or 8 months sober when I worked my really thorough fourth and fifth step. And sort of around that time, I realized that my obsession with alcohol had finally been lifted. Because, I mean, I had a years-long obsession with alcohol, even when I wasn't drinking. So it was a really hard mental habit to sort of get out of. And I just prayed about it and prayed about it and prayed about it and kept coming to meetings and kept doing my step work. And then one day I realized, like, just for one day, I didn't think about alcohol at all. I didn't think about how much I wanted to drink. And over time, you know, it was like a day here, a week there. And then, I don't know, at some point after my first year-ish, I sort of was mostly gone, you know, but I'm a really obsessive person. And sometimes it's like creeps back in a little bit. It's just there and it's gone. You know, I might find myself like inadvertently, I'm just like zoning out and there's like an ad for alcohol or like a thing, you know, and I'm like, oh, what? No, don't need to look at that. That's fine. But that's about, you know, what it got to. It took a long time. And I'm really glad that I had like a whole community of people around me in Georgia at that time to talk about it with. And, you know, I had a lot of phone numbers. I called so many people in my first year, and some of them in the middle of the night, and they still answered. Thank God. I think that you don't have to answer the phone in the middle of the night. I actually keep my phone on Do Not Disturb at night because I don't want drunk people calling me at 2 a.m. because I need my sleep. But everybody has a different job to do. Just like not everybody is a service nerd like Mike and I. Okay, you don't have to be in a structured service to do service in AA. You don't have to answer your phone in the middle of the night to be a good AA. Everybody has a different role to play. And that is something I learned. You know, I don't have to do it all either. Thank God. And I really don't have to do much other than show up and do my best. I don't know, this program saved my life. There was also, I think it was around the time the obsession to drink was lifted, I realized that I really wanted to be alive, and I was grateful to be alive. I think there was a time, maybe 3 months in, where I stopped wanting to die. There was another shift where I wanted to live, and there was another shift where I was glad I was born. I have a distinct memory of being like, I had a resentment against my mom, and I told her this in person once when I was under the influence, that I wish that she had had an abortion. I had a resentment against her for birthing me. And I no longer had that resentment. It was lifted at some point. And I actually, you know, family is complicated. People are complicated. Relationships are hard. But with anybody, the best of relationships are hard. But now I do have a relationship with every member of my family. I have really meaningful relationships with my parents that I never had. Maybe when I was a child, like a young, you know, 7-year-old or something, I might have had a somewhat meaningful relationship with my mom, but relationship like I've never had before with my parents. In fact, my mom just came to visit me here in Maine about a month ago for 10 days, which was a really long 10 days for me. But, you know, I really love my mom. I'm glad she came to visit. It just occurred to me that when she was here, that I've never had a life worth coming to visit, you know? We would speak maybe once a year when I was drinking, and then I would see her, you know, maybe Thanksgiving and or Christmas. But Thanksgiving and or Christmas tend to be kind of drunken fights in my family, at least on my mom's side. My dad doesn't drink, so I would show up drunk to my dad's family Thanksgiving and Christmas and pass out on the couch, and there would be no alcohol there, and I would wake up really mad because now I'm kind of sober and I really want to leave, but I can't because there's nobody drinking here, you know, like, and I'm supposed to be here or whatever. But, you know, now I have this relationship with them that actually counts. Like, I remember when I made my amends to my mom, especially, my mom was Well, I guess I was at the top of my amends list because I did a lot of harm to me, physically, mentally, spiritually, and a lot of other people. But my mom was probably the second most giant amends. And I waited until I was like just hitting my first year in sobriety to actually make the direct amends. I talked to my sponsor about it, and we decided that a living amends would really be better because I could surely show up on her doorstep out of the blue and say, "Hey, Mom, I'm sober. Sorry, my bad." and that would mean nothing. And you know, especially in my family, people have sobered up a handful of times, and it's meant nothing in the end, you know, when you don't change your behavior. So the best apology I found was change behavior, and I actually just like worked on building a relationship with her. And one day we were out like walking in the park, and I made my direct amends, and I told her, and she didn't even know I was sober, because she didn't really know how much I was drinking or that it was abnormal. Maybe she didn't understand that, because I would sort of try to hold it together, you know, that once a year when I saw her in person, right? But and the other time a year that I called her, it was just for money. So, you know, whatever. But had a lot of amends to make, and when I finally made my direct amends and I explained to her that I'd been in recovery for almost a year, she was like, "Wow, you know, I had no idea. I just thought that you hated me and that now you love me again." And I was like, "Ooh, I didn't like that, but I was also like, well, at least it showed." At least whatever living amends I had been making were very clear to her. She could see the change. But also I was like, "Oh man, I never hated my mom. You know, I just hated me and took it out on my mom." And I learned that in AA. I didn't know that. I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know what a resentment was. I didn't know that I had a resentment against my mom because I was born. I didn't know I had a resentment against the people that I hung out at bars with because they could drink and I knew that I couldn't. Even though really, I mean, should they be drinking? I don't know. It's not my business. But if they're drinking like me, you know, maybe I shouldn't need to have a resentment against them. Maybe I just need to feel sorry for them. As sorry as I felt for myself, you know, but it doesn't matter. I learned all that in AA. And, you know, I also got really involved in service, like they call it below the group level. And that's been a huge part of my recovery. Anything to be of service, I have found, to anybody, to Alcoholics Anonymous especially, because how do you repay the people, the program that saved your life? You don't. There's no repayment. I just do my best for the rest of my life, I hope, God willing, to pay it back, you know, to pay it forward. But I love to just be of service to anybody in any place, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the foundation and the footing to go do that. I have a job at a farm that is a food bank farm, so all the vegetables we grow, this is like my dream job. We just give everything away. We don't sell anything. It's a nonprofit, and like I had, you know, a lot of restaurant jobs, and I love feeding people, and like my favorite part of restaurant jobs was like when some homeless dude would come up to the back door and I would like sneak him some food that I was stealing, but for him, you know, and like feel really good about myself, right? But this is like the real deal, and I would not have this job. First of all, I wake up usually between 5:30 and 6 every day. I was often going to bed between 5:30 and 6 every day. There's no way I would be a farmer. I would wake up between 4 and 5 p.m., you know, when I was drinking, truly. I was mostly the second shift. I was the closer. That was my nickname, was the closer, because I loved to close because you could drink while you close. And I don't know, it's like a notorious thing, in restaurants especially, that the like second shift is just the wild. It's the wild place to be. Like, first shift was always boring. So that was my place. You know, those are my people. And now I have flipped to the opposite. I have a wonderful job, a wonderful partner. We just adopted a dog. And that's been an adventure, a little puppy. I couldn't do any of this if I was drinking. And I have more, not just like the outside things. Not only am I not homeless and I have an apartment, this is the longest I've ever lived anywhere in my adult life. It hasn't been two years yet, but that's really saying something. I was a real bounce around kind of person. I heard somebody say I had PMS, pack my stuff. They didn't say stuff, but you get it. If it got hard, I would just leave or be evicted. That happened sometimes. you know, I don't have like even, well, the dog can be a little chaotic, but she's calming down. And other than that, I don't have any like dull roar of chaos and insanity, which I have had up until the last couple of years. I'm coming up, God willing, in like a month, I'm 4 years sober, but I haven't had, Thank Thank you. I haven't had, up until like the last couple of years, really, I've never lived a life where I didn't have a dull roar, at the very least, a dull roar of insanity going on, you know, under the surface. And I hope to say, I think that people closest to me could confirm this, that I also, most of the time, don't have a dull roar of sanity, of insanity under the surface in my mind, in my spirit. And I really attribute that to AA, and whenever I am having a rough time, I just think, like, how, I pray, God, please help me be of service. Who can I help? How can I be of service to the sick and suffering beings out there? You know, how can I bring love and beauty forth into this world? And if I can manage to, like, get out of myself and whatever self-pity or stressful thing I'm having, it really, it becomes a good day again. And I learned I can start my day over at any time. And I didn't figure any of this out on my own. And then the cool thing about, like, the structured service is that I think between going to meetings in District 9 and going to all these, like, structured service things in Maine, I'm looking out at the crowd right now, I think I probably know at least 50%, or at least recognize the face of, like, at least 50% of the people in this room. And that's such a special feeling. I was, like, you know, a little nervous. I think I was actually less nervous than I thought I would be, but I was still pretty nervous about this. And that, as people started trickling in the room, I'm like, oh, I know him, I know her, I know him, I know her, that person, I know them, like, oh, cool. All, like, whatever, just talking to a bunch of my friends. And just telling the truth as I experienced it, which is so much easier than what it would have been, you know, like, I don't have to make up a story or come up with an explanation or manipulation of what happened to make myself look good. I just know what happened and what it's like now. And what it's like now is that this is such a cliche, and I love it. I never hated it. When anybody was like, I have a life second to none, I was like, oh, I want a life second to none. That's cool. I have that. I have a life second to none. And I just, I don't know. When I go to structured service events, I get, like, even when sometimes it's a slog, it really is only for a certain kind of person, but is so fun for me. Like, it can be a slog, but everybody has a voice, and I'm here for that. You know, I want to make sure that every alcoholic is represented and that we are here to focus on the alcoholic who's still sick and suffering. Like, I heard somebody say one time, I don't know, maybe there's, like, a speaker sharing from the podium, but they're like, thanks. I think they opened with, like, hey, I just want to thank you all for praying for me. And I was like, what? And he's like, you know, whenever people say a prayer, sometimes they say, let's have a moment of silence for the alcoholic still sick and suffering. And that was me at one point. I was like, oh my God, that was me too. this is so crazy. We have so much in common. but, like, that's what we're doing. I think when I go to service events, to me, that's like a prayer in action, which is what AA is all about. It is an action program. So whatever way that I do things to be of service, whether it's structured service or some other thing, you know, making coffee, greeting is so important. Just like being a kind person to strangers, whatever I'm trying to do, you know, giving away food is to me a prayer for the alcoholic still sick and suffering. It's a prayer for a better world, the world that I hope to contribute to, you know, that's a prayer in action to me. And I just feel really blessed to be able to talk today, and honored, man, so honored. Like, I woke up this morning so grateful, which is not an uncommon occurrence, but, like, I was, like, tearing up. I was saying my prayers this morning, because that's one thing I do, you know, aside from, like, going to meetings and reading readings, and I sponsor somebody right now. For the first time ever, well, I've sponsored a couple of people that kind of, like, you know, it didn't work out. I don't know if they stayed sober or not, but I wasn't the sponsor for them. I mean, I was also, at that time, you know, like a 24-year-old with, or 25-year-old with 1 year of sobriety, so I probably wasn't a good sponsor for anybody. But, you know, I finally have somebody I'm sponsoring, and aside from, you know, sponsoring people, going to meetings, being of service in as many ways as possible, a big part of my routine is praying. I was saying my prayers this morning, and I was like, just, like, thanking God for this opportunity to come be a part of this roundup and hopefully say something that makes somebody's day better. And I'm starting to tear up. Like, I'm just so grateful and so honored to be here. And several people made a a very big point to be here to hear me, which is like such an honor. Somebody that couldn't be here was in Texas, sent me a message on Facebook a few minutes before this and was like, I couldn't get back because we talked about it. He's like, I don't think I'm going to be able to get back. And he sent me a message like, I'm praying you up right now. Like, just pray that you make somebody's day better and it'll all go fine. You know, I'm like, it's just like so kind. And all these, I mean, like, I don't know. I just feel so surrounded by so much love all the time in my life. I had a real nice, like, we have at the farm I work at, we have volunteers that come there for a couple hours a week. And had a real heart-to-heart with this one volunteer who had some knowledge of, like, AA and Al-Anon, at least, maybe some experience, I don't know. But he was like, wow, I never have conversations like this. This is so great. And I said, oh, I was actually about to say the opposite. In my life, I'm unsurprised now when every single person I talk to, I have like these deep heart-to-heart connections with these people, and then we share these like really intimate things about ourselves and our feelings and our experience, you know, and we see each other so honestly. I was like, this is like, it's not even a surprise that this just happened because this is all I ever do now, and it sort of has spoiled me. I'm not a hugely social person, and I basically have no capacity for people talking about, like, the weather and sports or whatever people talk. I'm just like, I just hate this. I want to leave. This sucks. Like, I've tasted, like, the real thing. It was like when I was, you know, not drinking but still using, and I had tasted the connection to God, but then I was gone. You know, it's like, I hate this. I don't want to do this anymore. But I don't know. I'm just really blessed and really grateful that you guys listened to me for this whole time, and thanks again for asking me to speak. Thanks.